Hello, and welcome to Mondays on Tuesdays podcast. I have a very interesting what I hope is a really important project for me starting. I'm trying to form a outline for economics that differentiates from sort of classical economics, because I have a lot of economists that I'm now following that I really like. Steve Keen, Clara Mettet, there's a lot of people doing really interesting things, and there's this phrase that comes up, which is, well, the classical economics got this wrong, and here's how, and I think that's true. I think my entire career I've looked at the business space generally and being like, what? Why are you making that decision? Is this really, as deep as we are going to think about what we're doing? But I don't want to be another reactionary saying those people are wrong. I want to actually form a new way of evaluating business. And I call it transformative economics. And it's contrary to two concepts. The first concept it's contrary to is what I would call extractive economics. And the second thing it's contrary to is the concept that profit is the sort of root driving force of a business. And to the transformative versus extractive idea, the concept is pretty straightforward, which is extractive economics is like, you get a golden goose that lays eggs, you take the eggs, and that's it. And transformative economics has a lot more to do with using time and a transformation over time to produce value. And it's less about, it's still extractive because, if you are applying heat to an ingredient to extract flavor from it, you're extracting flavor. But it's the application of the transformation that yields value, not just the fact that you have the spices in your cabinet, right? It's the application of the spices to the water and the timing that is yielding value. And then to the point about not just profit but value, I've always been skeptical of the idea that profit is what drives a business, mostly because I've watched businesses do ridiculously stupid things that leave money on the table that seem to be more like territory moves or ego moves or the convenience of not really thinking things through kind of thing. And so I've always been like, are you people just rich enough that you don't care about money anymore? And those of us who actually do are struggling to find ways to improve your business that you just can't be bothered to accept. So that was the experiential complaint about profit. But I now have a more calmer and softer and more polite argument. And here it is. If profit was a fundamental aspect of business, there would be no such thing as an unprofitable business. Ever. Not like you're unprofitable for a while and then you're profitable. And here's the argument I will make for value-driving business. So, value is the idea that whatever operations you have in a business must be supported by income. That income can come ideally from revenue, alternatively, from investment, and alternatively from reserves or assets or what normal people like me would call savings. And the idea is that value, which is, the money coming in, funding the things that are happening to produce things that then bring in income, that is a fundamental aspect of business that may or may not generate profits over time. And the pursuit of value may or may not be for profits, or it might just be to keep the lights on. And so I think value is a more important thing to talk about in terms of business than profit. Profit's cool, it's an eventuality. It's not actually a requirement because if you can fund your operations, you can keep going. And after the break, I'll talk a lot about the Seneca system that I'm building, why I'm building it, and how it fits into this model of transformative economics that are value, value driving. And yeah, after the break. Yeah, so wow, I mean, what a last few years it has been for me, and I think for a lot of people. I was living cushy and comfortable in New York City with a high income, and finally found a company that would tolerate my autistic and productively inconsistent antics. And I'd been at the same company for 4.5 years, which was like, I don't know, 8 or 9 times longer than I was usually at a company. And COVID hit, and working from home from my apartment in Brooklyn was not a huge departure from what a lot of people dealt with during COVID, where their work was disrupted, or being in the software industry, it just was, wasn't that big deal to be on a computer. In Brooklyn, I heard sirens absolutely all the time, and that was scary. I mean, COVID was scary. I mean, don't get me wrong, COVID was scary. But economically, it was not very disruptive to me personally. And I don't know, like I didn't have the, I'm gonna, learn how to bake bread or consider my life choices at that time that a lot of people report. But after COVID, the New York City grind got kind of old. It really did. I felt like, something shifted in the air. And so something shifted in the air for my partner at the time as well, and we ended up moving to England. They went back to school and kind of left the digital industry, and that kind of set me on a road to getting sort of both really excited about some passions I had, some side projects I was working on. I was always like writing C code to understand more deeply how the dynamic languages I was using was working. And eventually, I got laid off as the software industry began really winding down, sort of towards the end of 2022. Really was kind of like everything kind of started melting down. And I had been so bruised by the working world. I had left New York City and moved to England, and I was kind of in this like chasing something mode. And that eventually left me to give up on the corporate world and the software world entirely, but not entirely, because I tried to start my own company that had a software language that I considered to be important as like an infrastructure investment for an industry that had kind of gotten really accustomed to, from what I could tell, rebuilding the same things over and over again. I mean, towards the latter years of my career, I felt a lot more like, I don't know, like a drywall mason, just kind of like screwing the same things in all the time. I mean, it really was a sort of creativity had left the building kind of time. And I tell this section of the story because now it's been 3 years of me building this ecosystem. I moved back to, not far from where I grew up in Iowa. I eventually ended up working in restaurants to pay the bills. That has been really tough in terms of, lifestyle income. It's really not a lot of money. It's also, it's hard work. It's enjoyable. I do love kitchens. But as I'm building this software, project runtime thing, and then also in kitchens, I'm cooking a lot and I'm really enjoying cooking, and I'm starting to understand what it is that restaurants have done really well that software companies have not done well. And then, with the politics in America and people, looking at history, and there's all these great YouTube videos about like a sort of more accurate yet more disturbing version of American history, I'm starting to look around and realize that what I'm actually after with the Seneca system is kind of a return to more creative business than I had ever experienced. And I think the reason for that is, the term I hear tossed around, Pokenet, the economists that seem to have greatly failed us through advocating for things like trickle-down economics that either doesn't work, is an all-out scam. Either way, it's horrible. It does nothing other than separate the rich and the poor further, which actually breaks down everything for everyone. And so what I'm talking about in this podcast is the idea of transformative economics as a way of viewing, building, and sustaining businesses. And it comes down to this fairly simple idea. So the I think the phrase that captures this the best is the common phrase, if you play your cards right. If you play your cards right. It's this idea of we don't get to choose the cards we have in our hand because we're drawing random cards from the deck. And that's kind of the idea of whatever situation life puts you in, that's where you are. And the way forward is not to, you know, run around asking for, you know, help that's not available. The answer is to take what you have and use that to navigate yourself into what you want, if you can. Now, obviously, we have a lot of problems with our work situation. You know, sending out 1,000, you know, job applications online is not going to do it. So there is some debate about, like, what cards do you even have? But I think that whatever cards you do have in the business world, these are called, you know, assets and staff, at, you know, and strategies and resources. Whatever cards you do have, it is important to play them in a way that you can navigate your way into having what you want. So what's a concrete example of that in extractive economics? Extractive economics is you own a franchise that maybe serves sandwiches. And every day you can expect to sell a certain number of sandwiches, and you must hire people to make the damn sandwiches. And that's it. And you are taking home whatever money you make that is above your expenses, and you hope they stay consistent. We all know they won't. We know the price of this will go up and down, and, you know, staff will call out sick and you'll have problems and all these things. But the extractive model is you own something, it produces this, it costs this, what's left over? That's it, right? Which to me seems pretty naive and shallow. And so a transformative version of this would be your staff is people who spend time, and your location is a location that exists over time. That period of your location exists has a certain amount of foot traffic, different times of the year, different amounts of traffic on different weather days. These are all factors that are very, very important. Now, in addition to that, the way to run a value-driven, successful business is to make sure that when your staff is in the building, they're doing something that yields an experience and a product that people come in and they want to pay for. So the questions now that you should have is, if you were to invest in training them a certain way, how much more productive would they be? That is a transformative opportunity that you have. If you combine the raw ingredients that you have that have a higher or lower price point, does it create an experience that you can sell your sandwiches for a higher or lower amount? Are there ways to prepare the ingredients of your sandwiches that will take more or less time? Does that more or less time yield a, you know, more appealing sandwich? And so now we're taking a view of this sandwich business that has a lot more to do with how you arrange the activities and where you spend your energy and where your staff spends their energy. And it creates a more interactive conversation about, you know, why do people come to the sandwich shop? It's not like the idea that this is, you know, a machine that keeps going, you know, like the Energizer Bunny, you put a battery in and it just goes and goes and goes. It has a lot more to do with the transformative aspects of what's happening and what people actually want. And let's be very clear about something. The transformative reason for people coming in is really important. Are they coming in because they like the music? Are they coming in because they want protein because you have a lot of people, you know, on their way to a workout? Or because lately, you know, the trends of food is always, you know, a sort of like myopic single value. For a while, it was no fat. And, you know, at one point it was low carb and now it's high protein. But ultimately, if people eat these sandwiches and don't feel good, they won't come back. And so a lot of this kind of is like taking the innards of a company into the outards of a company. Because I hear, like, my experience of business has been there seems to be this like crazy extractive profit or nothing thing that comes down. And then the idea is that the actual operations of the business are just kind of like secondary. Like, that's what the people do. And I'm trying to turn that inside out to have the transformative model actually be the model. So what, you know, all businesses are always going to have a balance sheet. That balance sheet is, do the expenditures balance out with the incomes? It's always going to be there. You're always going to have, you know, a retained earnings sheet because it's the best way to track your investment and your assets. And you're always going to have an income statement that's more like a scheduled breakdown of when stuff's coming in and going out. So it's not just like the balance sheet that overall says, you know, do we have profit or loss on a grand scale? But the income statement's a lot more of like, how does the timing line up, right? And I would love to see that reflect more of the transformative operations of the business. I don't have the accounting knowledge to do it, but I think there's really, really profoundly something here to move business from an extractive model of a golden goose you own to a transformative model of how do you spend your time and what are the transformations. And we can move this model out of the restaurant industry and into the software industry and say, you have staff that over time produces things that then become products with features. And here's where this gets really interesting. If you have three teams building something that combines together to make one thing, they can do that at the same time. But if one of your teams stumbles across something they need from the other team that they didn't know about until late in their project, you have just knocked out of a parallel process of delivery into a sequential process of delivery. So you have three teams. Let's say each engineer costs roughly $10,000 a month. There's three engineers per team. That's a burn rate of 9 × 10, roughly $100,000 a month. So let's say each team of three engineers is building something for a month. You're expecting to have a product for $100,000. In week three of this process, team one discovers they need something from team two that makes team two start over. Guess what just happened? You are going to have to pay all nine software engineers for 2 months because team two has to start over. So this is an idea of transformative economics gone wrong, because now, even if team A and team C, assuming it's, you know, ABC, if team A and team C don't actually need to do anything for that second month, you still got to pay them. So this is the kind of thing that warrants things like prototyping, things like maintenance, things like making sure the code base is clean. And what's amazing to me is that within the software industry, it is maddeningly hard to explain this kind of scenario to people who are just like, features, 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 you're a golden goose, lay some damn eggs. And I think the transformative value process is much more about sitting with and distilling what it is that you're doing, why, what the value is, what the output is, and start to understand that activities over time actually is the most fundamental aspect of business. And that means that training has value. This is going to sound surprising too. Most business leaders, that if you spend time training your staff, you get better productivity out of them. And my experience of the business world has been, it's like, how do I do this? Oh, you're such a bother requesting my time. It's like, yeah, it's your business, buddy. Like, I'm requesting your time so I can do a better job. And this is one of those things that makes me think that business culture, particularly American business culture, has been on a much more extractive model than a transformative model, because if it was in a transformative model, investing in training would be a lot more obvious and there would be a lot less friction and there were a lot more excitement and motivation, because I believe, you know, let's go back to that software example, teams A, B, and C, each of which costs $9,000 a month. If I am so bad at math, 9 × 3 is 30, not 100. I am even worse at math than I thought. 30. It is 90. I was right. See, I'm not kidding that I'm strangely smart and dumb at the same time. Okay, so $90,000 a month, roughly $100,000 a month. If those teams had taken 3 days to kick the tires on their design before hauling in and realizing they had an issue in week three that cost team B to start over, that would have saved the company, $60,000-$70,000 in salary. And I've seen this kind of thing happen. I mean, those numbers are, fake. It's fictitious. I have my, dyslexic number thing probably confusing the crap out of everybody listening. But I have actually seen this kind of a thing happen where you get into a project and all of a sudden a hitch happens late in the project and it causes very expensive engineers to twiddle their thumbs for a long period of time. This is a very real experience. And that idea of when you invest time and where you invest time sort of rearranges the transform from assets. Now you have, hey, the financial value. So what am I building with the Seneca system? So the Seneca system is a runtime that boils down the operations of a programming language innards into something that can be understandable through very basic computer science in small pieces with a lot of reuse. And I'll talk about where that starts and give a quick summary of what it's doing. And then I'll talk about why I'm connected to this transformative economics concept and the idea that value is the root of business because profit is actually derived from value, not the other way around. So Seneca really starts with the idea of string buffers and string buffer management. And for those not super technical, a string is essentially a sequence of letters or numbers. Letters or numbers doesn't really do it justice because, there's 26 letters in the Latin alphabet and then punctuation and numbers, and you don't get up to 255, which is what you can store in 8 ones and zeros. And so a lot of information like an image or a sound file uses a wider range of values than you can visually see. And so it's called a string of bytes, which is kind of a sequence of letters. Anyway, you can think of it as a sequence of things, all of which are, 8 ones and zeros. So almost everything in a computer comes down to managing strings. Managing strings and then applying the operations of computer science to strings. So you move your mouse pointer, the mouse is, lasers are bouncing off your mouse pad or your desk or whatever, and sending signals in the form of numbers to your computer, and your computer interprets that as motion and moves the mouse pointer around your screen. Well, you can actually see this as a string of numbers. You send a web request. It's got a whole bunch of information about who you are, what browser you're on, what page you're looking for. That is a string, or a series of strings. If you consider a new line would make it a new string, and then the web page comes down and it is again a series of strings. So passing strings around really is a fundamental operation of a computer. So what I built with Seneca is a system of tagging strings in small pieces and then building them back up into larger bodies by storing them in sequences of sequences. This is not a new or revolutionary concept. But I built an entire system that way that can always store and then put things back together in chunks that are smaller than 4096. And 4096 is important because it's generally the way, the sort of smallest increment of memory. And then I built a flexible array system so you can have sequences of sequences to manage this that fits within these small pages and then gets reassembled. And then I built a memory manager that allows you to indicate, which pages you're using, which pages you're, you may need to use. And then something interesting happens with Seneca, which is that you can take these memory pages and just throw them to disk and annotate the addresses and then send them to a different machine or bring them back up. And then because you have these systems that are simplistic, you have the ability to iterate over these dynamically scaling arrays that are like powers of 16 because they nest, and I have an algorithm for that. I guess you can call it an algorithm. It's really just kind of a summation. And then I started building things like key value storage in a really simplistic way. So I have the flexible arrays called a span, and then I have a table, which is basically like a key value resolution that kind of takes the place of a hash table, but it's not quite a hash table because it's designed to be flat so that you can pull the indexes of the items out and use them later, which is kind of in the vein of, you know, static classes from V8, or, you know, the formal term of polymorphic inline caching that was all the rage around, I think, like 2008 when the Chrome browser came out and they made JavaScript really fast. So the entire system is designed to do what language innards do in a really simplistic and combinable way with all the basic elements you would have in a language and a runtime. And then it has a pattern matching system that can extract tokenized value from formats such as JSON, HTML, HTTP, SMTP, and it also, you know, can parse, you know, DSLs and tokenize them and emit the tokens in a simple way. And why the hell have I done all of this, right? Why have I built these components when you have them in Python and Go and Java and all these things? And the reason is that you have them, but they have drifted far apart. I'll give you an example of what that means. So in Python, you have frameworks like Django that are web frameworks. You have the internal HTTP like serve component. And then you have a very completely separate SMTP email component. And getting these things to work together requires a lot of custom code. I mentioned earlier in the podcast that over time I felt like a drywall mason being asked to, you know, hammer out the same things, and the creativity was kind of gone. Well, going down in Seneca to the very basics of strings and memory management means that the pattern matcher that understands all those different formats works in the same way and reuses all the same components. The memory manager uses the same components that the pattern matcher is using in terms of the iterator and the array allocation. The memory manager has this really interesting chicken or the egg thing where it actually allocates a page that it then itself lives in. So it's like, give me the memory and then I'll place metadata about that same memory inside of it, very like dream within a dream style, chicken or the egg stuff. And so basically what Seneca is designed to do is increase the transformative value because you have things happening flexibly in a similar enough way that now you can use your creativity to combine things. And so software engineering becomes much less of a logic problem and much more of a multiplication problem. It's not, how do I write the if-else statements and how do I create these sort of object-oriented, you know, classes that take an incoming email into the result of a web page. It's how do I multiply the parser component with the handler component so that it spits out the page when the email arrives. So there's a word for this, it's called pipelining, where instead of defining logic, you're defining components that get routed around. And the only way that Seneca provides extreme value for this is the idea that these pipelining concepts are very, very combinable. So it's kind of far-fetched to be like, hey, I'm one guy over 3 years building something that goes down to the innards, but I do believe that the infrastructure of software languages has not really gotten a lot of attention. We are using most of the time Java, Python, C, C++, JavaScript, and they all date back to like the, you know, the 80s or 90s. And so what I've tried to do with Seneca is break down these very, very basic components, and everything I have to do, it's a combination of these components. And that means that it's way more complex to write. It is actually really maddeningly hard to work on right now. And I wonder, bringing this back to transformative value, how much of the leanings of business into extractive value is actually because it's easier. Because having conversations about how your staff spends their time or the potential for adjusting the flavor of a sandwich to attract more customers or thinking deeply about the experience they have. That kind of approach to business embraces the complexities of life. The extractive model, the golden goose that just lays you an egg and you get to move on with your day, it does not. So the way Sydneka works, the way transformative economics works, and by the way, that's just my term for the way I see economics, one of the things about both of them is the idea that they are more complex than people are used to. Dealing with the Sydneka system in its current form, eventually there will be a visual scripting layer on top of it, and you'll be able to use likely whatever syntactical language you're used to, like, you know, Python, JavaScript interface, whatever. But right now, it involves dealing with the transformative complexities and really meeting the computer where it is. And transformative economics is the same way. It involves meeting your business where it actually is and talking about what raw ingredients do you have? What transformative actions do you have that translate those things over time into something combined with value? How is your staff spending your time? How are you spending your time? And this really just involves a more in-depth engagement in business, in software, in restaurants, in cooking. And I think that's actually really, really important for the times that we're in, because I would not underestimate the amount of drift that we're experiencing, the amount of sort of stagnation that's happened in strategy, the idea that like the finance department and the HR department and the C-suite is just like walled off away from people, and they're just supposed to, you know, crack the whip and collect the profits for the investors, and the rest of us are just supposed to figure it out. And I actually think that is a recipe for disaster. And the recipe that makes a lot more sense is to have a real analysis and application of the things you have, how they transform over time, and how they can combine to produce value. And I'm hoping to have, you know, more formal sort of potentially like a white paper on how this breaks down. Some examples that don't involve my dyslexic calculus of how basic numbers do or do not combine. Get it in writing, get some formulas, and I think it actually could be a real way forward, because there are people very effectively and wonderfully pointing out how classical economists have failed us. That's an important thing. I'm not qualified to do it. I'm very glad other people are doing it. But at a certain point, we can all admit that classical economics has failed, and we have to replace it with something. Like, you have to populate the lines on your balance sheet and your income statements and your retained earnings with something real. And from what I can tell, the most like nuanced that accounting gets for intangible assets is concepts like brand value. Like, you're likely to sell if you're a name brand, recognized brand. And that's about as like intangible as they get. Like, they're really not talking about how people are spending time or any actual in-depth analysis of anything in your business that leaves the physical realm. And given that, you know, 70% of the economy is service-based and has no physical goods behind it, it's about time we have a cleaner and more in-depth look at the intangibles of a business and the actual, you know, transformative aspects of it. So I'm excited. I hope this made any amount of sense. I know from people that the Sydneka system does not yet make any amount of sense. I have a demo coming up of it being a few different kinds of network servers at the same time that I think will be like the first breakthrough where people can say, oh, I see what it does. So that's exciting. Yeah, I'm getting fired up about transformative economics. I hope it can be an inspiration sometime soon. And I will record another one of these very soon.